Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan. Welcome to joining me with the greatest audience in the whole field of mental health, psychology, psychiatry. Last week, I had on Michael Woolery, who talked with us for that hour about so-called primitive folks, about an African tribe that was just beyond the Stone Age and beginning to develop a little dairy and a little keeping of animals and a little bit of farming. And we looked at human nature. Who are we? What are human beings? Because we evolved over millions of years before we started in cities 10,000 years ago. And today, and I'll introduce my guest in a minute, after a little bit of a divergence, but today we're going to be talking with a man who is a professor in classics. So we can take another look at who we really are. Before that, I want to remind you that we have the best conference of the year in our field coming up. It's just outside Tampa Bay in Florida, in a beautiful little town that's a wonderful place to visit. It's being held at a hotel and a spa right on the bay. And the conference starts on May 3rd with presentations, workshops on various approaches to psychotherapy and education. And then on March 4th, I have a full day where I'm organizing probably the most exciting day you could imagine in terms of the latest developments in psychiatry. Peter Goetsche, who is the author of Deadly Medicines and a brand new book coming out, who's a part of the Cochrane Group in the worldwide research in trying to hold medical research to a higher standard, who's recently become acquainted with psychiatry. And he's from Denmark. He's speaking out as vociferously, if not more vociferously, than I have. He's a great researcher, a great orator. He'll be really interesting. And, of course, Bob Whitaker, who's known to most of you as a journalist, but I think a scientist. He didn't want me to call him a scientist, but I think he's one of the best scientists in the field today. We can do a whole workshop together on March 4th. We're going to have plenty of whole presentation. You know, you're going to be able to hear each of us for an hour and a half or more, and then you're going to be able to talk with us in a panel. And then on Friday, Peter is going to give, Goetsche is going to give a plenary. I'm going to do a workshop. My workshop is going to be oriented entirely around just interacting with folks about whatever you have on your mind. Really great opportunity to be with me and me with you. And perhaps the only one of the year. I don't have anything else planned in the United States next year. I'll be Skyping to Mexico City. The conference, you can get off of my website. Just go to my website, look at the very top of the headlines, and that will take you to the conference. It is a co-conference with the Adlerian Society of Florida. You could just Google the Adlerian Society of Florida conference. So you can get through it in a couple of ways, but go right to my website. Again, the whole conference is March 3rd through 5th. I'm going to be heavily involved March 4th and 5th. Now, today, my guest is a friend of mine. He's here in Ithaca. He's at Cornell. His name is Michael Fontaine. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am, Peter. How are you?
Good. You sound great, Michael. I'm so glad to have you on again. We do have to have lunch together, though, and not just talk through phones in the next couple of weeks, I hope.
Sure, that sounds good to me.
Michael's a professor of classics at Cornell, and so What do you think he's doing here? Well, let me read to you his special interests. They include ancient comedy, Virgil, classical ideas about the mind, psychiatry, or mental illness. And hence he's got two recent projects that look at schizophrenia in the classical literature from an unorthodox perspective. That is one that looks a little more like yours and mine than conventional psychiatry. And he's going to tell you about those projects. I'm not going to read that to you. And he's also got started learning about Thomas Sass, who's, of course, no longer with us and whom I studied with decades ago, and he's become a student of Sass and his work, and of course he and I have gotten together and we've been reading each other's work, and I've had him on this radio show once before. So with great pleasure, my friend Michael Fontaine, and Michael, just pick up wherever you want on this stuff.
Oh, thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be back on, so thank you for the invitation. I thought maybe I could just remind your readers what we mean when we say classics in a university setting, because that could bring all kinds of ideas to mind. And it means specifically the study of ancient Greece and Rome. And the time periods that we typically focus on are about 2,500 years ago, so a very long time ago, although not so long in terms of, say, evolution or anything like that. The people back then were just like the people today are. And in particular, the papers I've been working on now look at some of the literature from the 5th century B.C. in Athens. That's the golden age of Greece. So when people go to Athens today and they see the Parthenon or they see the ruins that all the tourists go to see, the ancient drama that I've been looking at was written and performed right around the time all that stuff was being built. And in fact, it was this particular play that I'm interested in debuted in the theater that is on the south slope of the Acropolis. Called the Theater of Dionysus, and people love to go take a look at the ruins. And so I've been asked by a number of people over the last few years why on earth a professor who studies ancient Greek and Latin literature is interested in psychiatry today. And the question used to really surprise me because I thought it was obvious. And the idea is that psychiatry as we know it now dates itself to the European Enlightenment, so 300 years ago. And before that, we know that Europe was dominated by institutional Christianity. And so the question is, what did people think all these mental illnesses and the medicines or the drugs that affect them, what they were before Christianity was there? And people in Greece and Rome and all over Europe had traditional religions. That was the same time period that scientific medicine was coming on. Hippocrates, the famous doctor, was getting his start right around this time period. Now, of course, his understanding of the human body was imperfect in the sense that they didn't have microscopes, and so he believed in the humoral theory of the body. But what I found as soon as I started looking, first is that the doctors, by and large, in the ancient world really did not think that mental illnesses that we're all familiar with, all these labels or these behaviors, that they were necessarily medical concerns. They definitely had many of the same issues, but they often looked at them in existential or philosophical terms. And when I started looking more into the modern psychiatric literature, Peter, I was extremely surprised to find that textbooks of psychiatry and reference books of psychiatry date the emergence of schizophrenia on planet Earth to the year 1809. So that's just 200 years ago. And according to several of the standard works, or at least the works that have been presented to me as standard, we're told that schizophrenia emerged in London and in Paris in the same year in 1809, and then the number of cases started to escalate hugely. They started to skyrocket. And so people have started comparing that with the emergence of AIDS, or before that with the emergence of syphilis, and it's led, as you can imagine, to all sorts of biopsychiatric approaches to schizophrenia. Everybody's looking for genetic causes or genetic mutations or brain disorders of various kinds. And as I understand it, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, no genetics are investigated when it comes to making a diagnosis of schizophrenia today. Is it still the case that schizophrenia is based, a diagnosis is based on behavior and question and answer?
Oh, absolutely. There's no evidence for any biological or genetic cause for the constellation. If there is one, it's very, very rough one. If there is one, people with hallucinations and delusions, you know, who withdraw from reality.
Okay.
It seems to be a human experience.
Well, this is what makes part of what makes this recent work of mine kind of interesting is that I started off writing about it in terms of paranoid schizophrenia. But when I was in the middle of the paper, I learned that the new DSM abolished paranoid schizophrenia. Now they just call it all schizophrenia, along with the other, what used to be different subtypes. Now it's just one label. So I had this information on the one hand that schizophrenia, as we know it, only emerged 200 years ago. And then I found a literature review that said, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but I could find it, something to the effect of, in the vast literature of ancient Greece and Rome, there are no examples of schizophrenia. And I thought that was sort of surprising. And so this is where I have called what I'm investigating sort of an unorthodox perspective that I've taken in looking at it. There are some very famous works of Greek and Latin literature that feature characters, and these are fictional, but they feature characters that would look to me, and maybe to you and some of your audience if they read them, very much like the sort of behaviors we associate with people labeled schizophrenic today. And so the piece of literature that's commanded most of my interest is probably the most famous Greek tragedy ever written, or one of them, and it is by a playwright named Aeschylus. And let me spell that for your readers in case they want to Google and find out more, because it's kind of a tough spell. It's Aeschylus. And so this particular play debuted in the year 458 B.C. in Athens, and it was the second play in a trilogy called the Oresteia. Now, in this play, the second play features a young man, he's about 20 years old, who has returned to his the home where he was born to avenge the murder of his father. And so if you had seen the first play, you would know that in the first play, his mother had killed his father, her husband, when this guy, the hero, was a boy. And there's some backstory there, but it's sort of an interesting family scenario that might play some role in understanding all these dynamics. But so the hero of the play, his name is Orestes, his mother had murdered his father along with the help of her new lover that she had taken when the father was away at war. So that's in the first play. And then in the second play, the boy is grown up 20 years later. He'd been secreted away and raised in a hidden spot. And so he's come back today on the day of the play to avenge his father. And what's interesting is that when he arrives, he says, "The god Apollo has told me I must kill my father." And that's sort of an interesting claim to make. If you ask a typical person in my field of classics why this man Orestes would listen to that kind of order, they would say, well, that's what the god Apollo does. In that religious context of ancient Athens, the god Apollo delivers an oracle, and you listen to the oracle, and you have to do what it says. It's fate. You can't get away from an oracle no matter what you do. The strange thing, though, in the play is the young man says repeatedly that he has many motives for being angry at his mother, and his sister, who has grown up back home along with.
By the way, Michael, yeah. that of course I think is what you're hinting at is that we call that command hallucinations.
That's exactly right, Peter. That's exactly right. But it is that term has never been invoked in my field. But you, I'm sure, and I bet your audience, sees these kind of individuals in the newspaper, sadly, every week. A guy who kills one of his relatives or tries to harm one of his relatives and says, God was telling me to do it.
Or the voices, just the voice. Either the voices, God, could be God, or could be the devil, or could be often just voices are telling him.
That's right. And in this play, what's interesting is that even though oracles in other contexts can be delivered in several different ways. In this play, the young man constantly says he's hearing the voice of the god. And he says, I can hear the god's voice. It's terrifying me. It's scaring me. I can't resist it. It's telling me I must kill my mother.
And as you know, Michael, that's another quality of people who hear voices that are giving commands is that they're just often terrifying. They're unwanted. They're very, very, very frightening quite often, this initial experience of hearing voices. I'm interrupting a little bit just to kind of punctuate what you're saying, but please don't let me break your train.
I very much appreciate that because it helps set it in context, and it helps me in the sense that you immediately see where I'm going with this.
Yep.
And this is why I think our fields have so much they could say to each other. The way it gets interpreted in my field is they say, well, if God tells him to do that, that's what God, the God does. And that sounds kind of ludicrous. In the play, the guy is just like a guy today. He says, I'm so scared of these voices. I can imagine my horrible future. I don't have any power to resist them. And so the people in my field say, well, that's called a command oracle, and it's a good thing. He must kill his mother. And then they say it in favorable terms, like, well, this is, you know, revenge, and that's vengeance, and that's a good thing in this religious context. And I think all that looks kind of ridiculous from the modern point of view. And he does in the play. He goes on. So this is the most famous part of the play. You've seen it illustrated probably in artwork. If you go to a European museum, there's a lot of paintings of this. Orestes goes, and he disguises himself, and he murders his mother in cold blood. He murders the mother's lover at the same time. And as soon as he's done, Peter, this is the craziest part, the play ends right after he's killed her, and you would think it's a happy ending. Suddenly he starts shrieking, and he says, oh, my God, they're after me. I can see these demons rising up to come and get me. They're angry. They're going to torment me. And everyone around him, the chorus of the play says, no, no, Orestes, they're not real. Those are hallucinations. It's remarkable. The Greek word doxai means hallucinations. And he says, no, no, they are real. I can see them. You can't see them, but I can see them. And everybody else keeps protesting. That's not true. And then he finally says, I've got to get away from here. I'm going to run away from them. And as the curtain falls, that's how the play ends. We don't know whether they're real or not. And so as I think about this, how would that sound to you when a person says he can see or she can see these demons tormenting her because of something that he or she has done?
Well, it fits exactly into the model of somebody who's being tormented by voices. And generally, people who are being tormented by voices, unless they can find a way to come to grips with them, to change them, to get rid of them, to counter them in some way, the voices mostly are punitive, and you can't satisfy them. They're the voices of abuse, and the abuse continues even if you have carried out the voices. In fact, probably the most heartbreaking interview I ever had with a woman or a man, but in this case a woman, was in a prison for the criminally insane, a woman who had killed her son and tried to kill her daughter under command hallucinations that were caused, in this case, by psychiatric drugs. They were clearly related to huge change up right over the weekend before, a rise in her antidepressant medication. She continued to be horribly tormented afterward, and not just by the voices, but by such guilt, such remorse. It was just terrible. So I think it's very consistent. Aeschylus is a great observer.
That was my conclusion. Here we have a great observer of human behavior. He sees that people behave this way. He doesn't have any idea probably why they behave that way. But I think one explanation that would not have occurred to him is that this man, Orestes, that his brain was broken, basically, that there was some sort of genetic cause or neurotransmitter cause, that sort of thing. This was not a concern that was typically medicalized in the ancient world. That's not entirely true. There definitely are cases, and I mentioned one in this paper, where people make claims that they can hear voices and things. And some people think a doctor is in order. In fact, I discussed one of these cases with you the last time I was on your show. There was a comedy where a guy makes similar claims. He says, I can hear the voice of Apollo telling me to kill my wife. And the father-in-law, who's standing there, says, I'm going to go get a doctor. And he runs off to get a doctor who comes back, a scientific doctor, with drugs. And they want to try and hold this guy down and give him drugs. And of course, it's a comedy, so the guy escapes. But it's not invariably interpreted that way. That probably was a new thing when it was taken that way. But I was struck as I thought about this. Of course, this is your expertise. But how is schizophrenia, what we call schizophrenia, differentiated from PTSD? So I would think after somebody commits an act that makes them feel guilty and they have these, they're tormented by all kinds of awful sensations or hallucinations. And things. That sounds like PTSD to me, but that doesn't seem like it would be schizophrenia. Although what you just said is really interesting, that the abuse continues, the voice, the abusive voices continue even after a person carries out one of these commands. Is that common?
Yeah, I would say that's routine. Wow, we're into something so complicated. So let me for a minute try to just let go of the whole idea of diagnoses at all and tell you very briefly what I think about the issues you've raised. And that is that, first of all, hallucinations are very, very common. Many people, when they feel safe to report they've heard voices now and again, especially voices. And they don't mean a lot, and they're not of vast importance to the people. But people we see who have tormenting hallucinations almost always have an obvious history of neglect, abandonment, and terrible trauma, often very gross sexual trauma, when they're little. And I think it's interesting that Aristides is taken away from his mother and raised under some other circumstances, because quite often people feel very much not a part of their home, not a part of the family, who grow up having hallucinations. They feel alienated. There may have been a poor connections at the very early months or years of life with the people around them, or there may have been trauma from even outside the family, not necessarily family members. And so in a way, I view almost all the situations I see where people have these horrible persecutory hallucinations, that they're the voices of abusers. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to early childhood and sometimes continuing childhood abuse. So in that sense, if you had to use a diagnosis, you'd say it's all post-traumatic stress. And not necessarily even to be looked at as a disorder, that it is a response to very, very bad circumstances in childhood, in my experience. And
that's
some of these
really
people fit into different diagnostic categories, but I don't tend to think that way.
I think it's remarkable that you emphasize the family circumstances here. I, too, was really struck by that, that however you want to describe or sort of understand this response, and I like that word you used a lot, that it's a response rather than a disorder to terrible circumstances, that it does implicate all sorts of motives, and particularly this abusive childhood. You know, in this play, the mother has basically gotten rid of the unwanted son. There was violence against his father. She's got the new lover, and the kid is kicked out of the house. It's also remarkable. I wonder if you're struck. I thought I was struck. That the hero is about 20 years old in the play.
Yeah.
Isn't
that
about
a common age?
Kind of, yeah,
late adolescence and early adulthood is a very common time for these things to happen. And I think it's because individuals who have been that traumatized and have that vulnerability to be harassed by voices. I'm not talking about a saint who hears that God is love. I'm talking about these harassive, violent, terrifying hallucinations. Most of those folks have been quite injured in growing up, and when they get to the demands of adulthood, they have a lot of trouble handling them. And so I think, and they also have trouble handling the turmoil of adolescence, which is a time when people are also prone to hear voices and have all kinds of different sorts of emotional experiences that are off the adult charts. So adolescence and young adulthood is a very, very common time for this. And when people are trying to leave home or trying to have a relationship or struggling with gender identity and dealing with feelings of humiliation. Another part of this, and let me ask if the poet playwright Aristides sees it similarly. In my experience, this is not mostly about just guilt. It's not about something the person's actually done wrong at all. It's not like you do something bad and then you got voices chasing you. It's that you got voices telling you to do something bad. So it's not that people do a bad thing and then this is the result of these persecutory hallucinations. It's more bad things have been done to them. And then they develop these voices and they feel guilty and ashamed, but they haven't done anything wrong. They're often the nicest, most perfectionistic kinds of people who don't want to do anything wrong or bad. But a big component often is shame and humiliation, not just guilt, which is this more, we think of it as maybe a little later in civilization and has to do with the autonomous person, the concept of the autonomous person. But often people who are being horribly persecuted are being shamed and humiliated on a very primitive, horrendous level. Does this show up in the play at all or in classical literature?
I think the answer is yes. We are typically told that in ancient Greece in particular, that it was a shame culture entirely rather than a guilt culture. Now, some people have pushed back about against that.
Right.
Surely there was guilt. But
it's more subtle than that. But, yeah, that's the dominance, it seems.
That's it. Yes. Shame is a very important concept in ancient Greece, not just in the society in which the playwright lived, but the play that he wrote was set 700 years in the legendary past. And in his conception, the playwright, Aeschylus, would have thought of that time as being a shame culture. And so the Orestes, when he comes in the play, he says, I've got a few reasons for doing this. It's quite interesting. He says, I've got the god Apollo telling me to do it. At the same time, I'm pretty angry that my inheritance basically was stolen from me and I was forced to go live somewhere else. And he's angry about it. There's a scene, a very long scene, where he and his sister gather at the gravesite of their father. And they basically whip each other into a frenzy, saying, we got to go and kill Mom. This is crazy. She's really maltreated us. This is not the way it was supposed to have been for us. And they grow increasingly bloodthirsty about that. So I think you're right. It's a shame reaction to how they'd be perceived in that society.
The voice, however, is commanding them. The god is commanding them to kill Father, but they themselves whip themselves into feeling that they should kill mother too, or
it's the other way around. So the father is already dead, and he was killed by their mother.
I don't mean the father. The stepfather, or the, I guess he's not married. He didn't marry her. He's not a second husband.
No, he's the live-in boyfriend, and he's
okay. That's what I meant. That the orders are to kill the live-in boyfriend, but they themselves determine to kill the mother.
It's the other way, so that's a good question. The voice tells Orestes to kill his mother, but he also kills the stepfather.
Okay.
In fact, he kills
I don't know how I got that twisted around. I hope it's straightened out.
But the hero kills both of them, the mother and the stepfather, and even though it's not made clear that the voice is telling him to do that either. I mean, there seem to be multiple, some of them mutually incompatible motives for why the guy does this thing. And so, you know, what's interesting, I looked around in the newspaper just over the past year, maybe last 2-3 years, I found easily, quickly, a half dozen or a dozen instances of guys about age 20 to 30 doing this very same thing. And in every single case, and I'm reprinting some of them in the paper, in every single instance, these guys, after they'd killed their mothers, were found not guilty by reason of insanity. And they were sent to mental hospitals rather than to prison. And so
this
I was struck.
Go ahead.
So again, I was sort of struck thinking about this. And maybe you have some thoughts about this, Peter. Why does our legal system allow a plea of not guilty by insanity for murder? But it's extremely rare, if it happens at all, that we allow a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity for an equally heinous crime like violent rape.
Oh, that is interesting. Well, I think that in part, First of all, nobody wants to forgive the rapist, which is not a bad idea, not to forgive him. And also, it's unfortunately makes sense that rapists exist because we see them all the time. We know that men can be very, very abusive of women and take advantage of them. So it generally takes a crime that doesn't sit with your idea of human nature. It's just so interesting to think of it this way. The crime has to be off the chart, out of human nature generally, to get the idea behind it of it's being pushed by craziness or psychosis or mental illness, the various terms that are used. A disease of the mind is a really common one in the law, which are usually quite old. And I also think that you're more likely, if you kill someone in your family, you're more likely, rather than not in a rage. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, where people fight in the family and they get provoked and so on. But if seemingly out of the blue you murder somebody in your own family, it's very more likely that you're going to be in a very mentally disorganized, a terrified, hallucinated state than if you rape somebody. Because I think that rape fits just too much with human nature. My gosh, what do you think of what I'm saying?
Well, I don't know.
I've never said it before like that.
I had thought about it, and, you know, of course, this is not my expertise, but I thought a little bit about this. And I was wondering, so what it means to hear voices. When people say they hear voices, I imagine, you know, sometimes if I have had a medical exam, a medical test, and I'm waiting for the results, and I'm pretty worried about it, you know, whatever it's going to be, I could easily imagine my thoughts becoming audible and I could hear them, but I wouldn't myself characterize them as hearing voices, and so I've often wondered if that's the same thing or if these are really actual voices people can hear from across the room, and I read that some of them say, yes, they are. And, you know, in these murderous circumstances, these violent circumstances, people say, well, the voices that people, that the voices are irresistible. I can't do anything to stop them. And so I agree with you. It looks like rape is a heinous crime. It seems universal. And so it seems in that sense that these people, knowing they shouldn't be doing it, they do it anyway, and that they're driven by an irresistible urge. And so I had wondered if those were analogous circumstances or maybe our legal system considers, you know, one really irresistible but maybe not the other irresistible. And these are terrible things to think about.
Yeah. Well, the idea in the legal system that goes back to the original McNaughton, who was a man who killed or tried to kill the Prime Minister of England, but he killed his assistant. You know, they didn't have photographs and things. And he thought that the government was persecuting him. Actually, it's rather complicated because he did have political conflict with the establishment. So it's really complicated. But the idea was that it was insane for him to think that he was being persecuted by the government. And that's why he got the not guilty by reason of insanity for the first time from the House of Lords at the time. It was not particularly because of hallucinations or delusions, as I recall. It was because the act was driven by this, well, delusion, by this false idea, by this false idea. And that's always been the criteria. So presumably if you raped a woman because you thought that she was a demon and that, you know, that you're raping her was going to save the world or something, that it might begin to look to people like it was a crime of insanity. But I think it would be hard to push because it is such a common part of what men do and frequent enough and understandable enough to people as a part of human activity and human nature. And that we look for something that looks like the mind is no longer functioning according to the usual rules. I think that's what people are looking for, that there's a compulsion of some kind the person can't resist, an idea that's completely false and bizarre. But this is all so much on a continuum. And I have a lot of experience with this with juries. And in general, Michael, and again, folks, we're talking with Michael Fontaine, who's a professor of classics at Cornell. In general, Michael, juries are very loath to give anyone a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. Two cases that I can describe to you, neither of which I testified in court, one I was a consultant with, was the woman I mentioned to you earlier who was on Zoloft, great increase of Zoloft right when she was having more and more trouble, thought that that she was being told to kill her daughter and her son and shot her son and tried to beat her daughter to death. I mean, it was just horrendous. And the jury, I didn't participate because I don't do those kind of cases. I only do them where they want to go with a drug issue, because I'm very ambivalent about the not guilty by reason of insanity plea. But I'm not so ambivalent about involuntary intoxications where the brain is really, really destroyed or disturbed. And so they didn't end up using me, although I played a big role in the case. And the jury found her not guilty by reason of insanity. That is without the drug issue. They just thought she was so disturbed. Another case I had was a man who, by golly, I think he was also on Zoloft, who, without any involvement on my part on this legal case, he thought his wife was a demon and from another world. And then eventually he decided he was from another world who'd come to protect the world from her. And he crashed their car into a stanchion trying to destroy her. Was then stricken with remorse and was found on the road carrying her looking for help. And she survived. Oh. And he's a very nice man. I mean, I got to know him very, very well afterward.
And he was
a very kind gentleman. And I've written up both these stories in my book, by the way, in Medication Madness, has both these stories in detail in them. And those are the kind of cases that people see as so bizarre and strange and, quote, mentally ill, that a jury or even a prosecutor is willing to go along with a not guilty by reason of insanity.
You used a term just now I thought was pretty interesting. You called it involuntary intoxication. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a concept in the law and that I've been on the frontier of. I had the first involuntary intoxication case ever to be won in Virginia. And I've done a number of them around the country. And the idea behind it varies from state to state, but the idea behind it is that if you have been given a drug – either against your wishes, that is, LSD has been put in your drinking water or in your drink, and you do something destructive, that's could be an involuntary intoxication, especially if there's no other motivation for what you did, or if it's a prescribed drug, and the state laws vary, either misprescribed or prescribed without informed consent. It varies. But if it's a prescribed drug and you don't know that it can make you violent and you commit violence, that's an involuntary intoxication. There are fine-tuning from state to state. But basically, it's most of the cases I do are a prescribed drug where the person's not informed and has no idea that as they start to get violent, it could be the drug, and they're thinking it's entirely the circumstance and justified and righteous. And so, these are, I believe, are very legitimate cases. We know statistically that certain drugs, including the antidepressants, raise the likelihood of people committing violence.
Now, when these people are given drugs, I mean, we say that in the passive voice, but who is making them take these drugs? Are these drugs that their parents are giving them, their spouses are giving them, or are these drugs that the state is making people take in certain circumstances?
Now, most of these cases are people who are outside of a hospital, have gone to their physician, their nurse practitioner, sometimes even the physician's assistant with the monitoring of a doctor, and they get a routine prescription. My book opens medication madness with an individual who goes to his doctor for a prostate problem, I believe it was. He sees something he thinks is educational material, doesn't know it's just an ad for Paxil. And so he asks the physician's assistant, he says, you know, I'm kind of a person people said have some sadness. This is a very moral man, a spiritual man, a caring man, a family man. No history of violence whatsoever. In fact, I had to meet in a kitchen to talk to all the people in his community who wanted to vouch for him. There were too many to even meet individually. And he started his Paxil and immediately felt a compulsion to commit violence. In particular, it started out as suicide. Well, it was all about suicide, actually. And he didn't even know how to get a gun. He was so naive. And he ended up running down a policeman who was giving a ticket, jumping out of the car, saying, I don't want to hurt you. He actually broke the policeman's leg. I don't want to hurt you. I just want to get my gun and kill myself. And trying to wrestle his gun away, a good Samaritan intervened, and they took the gun away. And after I wrote my report on Paxil and how it had put him into this horrible, agitated, disturbed state, the police officer went for leniency. And this man did not end up spending much time in jail, but he did not celebrate with, wow, I got away with it. He just had so much remorse for the whole period of time I was in touch with him, quite a while afterward.
These are some terrible situations you're describing here. The ones you just mentioned, sounds pretty clear, like when you start introducing substances, drugs, maybe even certain foods, or whatever, people's behavior definitely changes. But I was thinking a bit about the hearing voices. You've worked with people who hear voices, have hallucinations. Is there a way to knock those out without using drugs, in your experience?
First of all, you can't knock them out with drugs. All you can do with drugs is reduce every mental function. And there is nothing specific about their reducing hallucinations. That's a myth. Okay. So if you go onto the hospital ward and you talk to the patient and you get their confidence, they'll tell you they still hear the voices, but they don't care about them anymore. But if you ask them about their ball team that they rooted for, or their wife or husband or children, they'll tell you they don't care about them either. So the drugs lobotomize chemically, literally. They literally crush frontal lobe function, and then the person cares less and is more docile. That's the effect of these drugs. The antipsychotic drugs like Seroquel, Invega, Risperdal, Haldol, Zyprexa, and so on. So they don't actually get rid of hallucinations at all. There's no way to do that. I wanted to answer an earlier question and then your more recent one. The people who experience hallucinations, whether they are persecutory, or even like the saints, you know, hearing the voice of God, these are clearer than every day. If you ask somebody about it, it's not only as clear as everyday life, it has a certain force, imperative, and clarity of sound. And if they're seeing them, clarity of vision that is beyond everyday life. So they are very powerful and they seem very real. Now, if you can build a caring relationship and a trusting relationship with somebody who's hearing voices, they can indeed diminish in front of your eyes, so that when you engage the person personally in a caring and trusting way, you can remind them through halfway through the conversation that the voices have either diminished or disappeared for a while. So to me, the whole thing about voices is that they involve trauma so bad, a loss of trust so great, that the person's relationships with other people are so impaired by distrust that they go into this almost a dream, unconscious state. And it's very dreamlike. A lot of hallucinations are like nightmares. They're very much like nightmares. And the person may even have similar nightmares. Now, can people get over them? Yes. People learn to get used to them. They learn to talk back to them. They learn that the more they do for themselves and the more they build social relationships, the weaker they get. Some people find they leave them behind entirely. Some people find that they're there a part of their lives, but they're under control and they're handleable in one way or another. So it's a whole big continuum of human experience that's handled in a wide variety of ways. We know for certain that the more people who are suffering like that take the antipsychotic drugs and other psychiatric drugs, the less likely they are to even have a decent or a marginal recovery. And the more they don't take the drugs, the shorter the duration or the absence of drugs, the more likely they have a good recovery. And we know that what helps recovery above all things is if you can get involved with the family of the young person. And there are studies about this. There are projects out of Finland about this and other places. And I did this kind of work going way back in my career. You work with the family. You can actually help young people get through the period of time and leave their voices forever behind. And there's no question about that. That's been proven now over and over again in a marvelous Finnish program called Open Dialogue. People can just Google Open Dialogue. It's a human experience, and I think it has to do with fragmentation of trust, especially in somebody who's already been very traumatized and maybe hasn't had the nurturing to give them a good, strong sense of themselves.
So this is something...
Go ahead.
If the government, or rather, if you're experiencing this problem and you're hearing these voices and they're scaring you and all these horrible things, I assume that your insurance company, if you turn to them, what do they typically do? Do they recommend drugs, medication, or will they pay for these sorts of caring interventions where you can build and rebuild?
Well, most therapists can figure out a way to, if they want. See, they don't want to most. But most therapists, and certainly any psychiatrist, can figure out a way how to help these people and to keep the insurance companies at bay. That's not the problem. The problem is finding non-medical therapists who are brave enough or knowledgeable enough to do it, or medical therapists like psychiatrists who are willing to do it. But it generally can be done if the individuals want to do that, both the client and the provider want to do it. What we don't have is funding for the kind of program that works so well in Finland, where a team goes out to the home. Like, everybody in the city that they're in knows about the program, and if a youngster starts to have a breakdown, they get involved with the program. And it's been so successful with these more than one professional, several professionals working as a group with a very open kind of dialogue and conversation and support for all the family members and not focusing on the identified patient in particular. They've eradicated schizophrenia because the patients get better before 6 months, which is how long you're supposed to wait before you can diagnose schizophrenia. And the disability rolls are down, unemployment rolls are down.
Peter,
it's really worth
checking
out, Open Dialogue. Yeah.
Has anyone tried that Open Dialogue approach on American college campuses? I think a lot about this here. I work at Cornell, but, of course, I keep an eye on what's happening on campuses all around the country. And all
the campuses are horribly drug oriented. Now, we do have a couple of places in the U.S. now that you can again Google that are starting to do open dialogue. And I had some folks like that at my previous conference last year. But the federal government has then NIMH announced that even though it's obviously the best program in the world, the only one that documents with paper after paper a statistically huge success rate, that it just wasn't right for America.
Oh.
That's how much the National Institute of Mental Health is in the drug company pockets.
Well, this is interesting. I have Googled around quite a bit, of course, like anybody, and right square on the website for NIM, the National Institute for Mental Health, it says, what is schizophrenia? And it answers, it's a severe, lifelong brain disorder.
Isn't
so
that evil?
I mean,
that's just PR for the drug companies. I'm so glad you did that. It's an abomination. It's a shame, and it's a crime.
It doesn't even suggest on the website that there are other interpretations out there. You don't have to say those interpretations are correct to acknowledge that maybe there's some work going on and the things.
Oh, yeah, and huge scientific work. In fact, there's been I've had this gentleman on my the radio show too, but we have extensive studies now showing that the long term prognosis is really great if you don't give them a lot of drugs. And this is heavy duty statistical epidemiological research, and NIMH has now cut off funding for them, and they're being somewhat supported by a foundation, the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, which is a really good group, but the government cut them off. That's what they think of really good research. They don't want it.
What does the American Psychiatric Association have to say about any of this? Do you kind of keep up with their journals, their literature, that sort of thing?
Oh, of course I do. In fact, I'm a member. I'm a life member of the American Psychiatric Association. It's a trade union for the drug companies. It used to be, I'd say, it was a trade union for psychiatry. Now it's actually a trade union for the drug companies. Even psychiatry comes secondary to the funding and support they get from the drug companies. I'm sure that the union dues that psychiatrists pay to belong to the Psychiatric Association are paltry compared to the support, the massive support that they get from the drug companies. In fact, right now, the American Psychiatric Association has pressured the FDA to offer that it's going to approve electroshock treatment for routine treatment without ever studying it.
Would that be something that the patient would ask for and receive, or is this something that the patient would be getting despite?
They're almost always bullied into it and lied to. They lied to. They're told it's harmless aspirin. I'd give it to my mother. I'd take it myself. And so they're lied and pressured when they're depressed and anguished to do this. And sometimes, and I've talked to people about this, that they hated themselves so much that it felt like it would be next thing to suicide. You know, okay, do it to me. But they're almost always pressured. They're always lied to, because who would take a treatment that we know is so devastating to the brain and mind? It's and for which there isn't a single controlled clinical trial that shows it has any usefulness.
And this is something that your insurance will start paying for? Is that what?
Oh, marvelously. A lot of many elderly women get shock treatment because they're covered by Medicare and they have nobody to protect them from it.
And what
determines whether you get shock treatment is nothing to do with your condition at all. It has to do with the moral condition of your doctor. If your doctor has a lousy moral condition and doesn't know how to do therapy, you get shock treatment.
Are women's groups aware that women on the whole tend to get this kind of treatment more than men do? I mean, is that something that they are curious about?
Yes. A lot of the best literature on shock has been done by women sociologists and psychologists and other women who have done retrospective studies and other kinds of studies of women subjected to shock treatment. And they find that it often satisfies the husband but not the woman, who becomes more robotic and less assertive after shock treatment. I have a website where you can actually plug in the word women and get women's studies on shock treatment. The website is ECT Resources, ECT, like electroconvulsive therapy, ectresources.com, .org. We've got just about 3.5 minutes left. This has been, I think, a really interesting program. I want to make sure, Michael, you've covered everything you're interested in covering. Take a second, think about this. What kind of summary thoughts do you have on your study of the classics and psychiatry?
Well, the hour has just flown by, hasn't it?
It's really zipped by.
This is it. It's a fascinating, absolutely fascinating connection I think we have here. People tend to study the classics because they're interested in human nature. They want to know no matter how long ago it happened, what the best ideas or the best literature about what it means to be human is. And psychiatry is trying to fix or look at the same issue and say, you know, what's out of range for normal? What is so unusual, so depraved, that it must be a brain disease or some have some other problem that maybe, you know, substances, drugs, medicines can fix for us? And so I would hope that if people are interested in this, and I invite your audience to maybe have a look for me on Google, they'll find me, Michael Fontaine at Cornell. At Cornell University, and they can email me, what these texts from so long ago can tell us about the human condition that all of us find ourselves in, what we can escape, what we can't escape, what behaviors we see today that look to us, we are used to calling mental illnesses and things, but were no less problematic, you know, 3,000, 2,500 years ago, but they were not considered medical matters, and they looked for other ways of trying to solve them. Philosophy, self-help, those were very big movements back then. And it sounds like what they're doing in Finland sure sounds pretty interesting to me. Like maybe we could at least pilot some of those studies here on university campuses, if anyone were interested in trying to do that. All we ever hear is that mental health on college campuses is our mental concerns are increasing. There's never enough funding. The students can't get an appointment when they want one. And it doesn't sound like anyone's happy. You know, the universities feel like they're not serving their students enough. The students aren't getting to see people that can maybe help them. And since nothing's working now, maybe we could try something a little different.
We would. Yeah, these particular programs could be especially based where students are living in their communities, because you need family involvement. So This particular program isn't going to work so well on campus unless it's unless the student, and many do, are living, you know, in their communities. Well, we're coming to a close. Michael Fontaine, thank you so much for being on the show. Folks, my two books that relate to this the most are Medication Madness, which we've mentioned, but also my book on guilt, shame, and anxiety looks at the issues surrounding hallucinations and madness in general. But most of all, don't forget the great conference we're having in Florida on Tampa Bay, March 3rd, 4th, 5th. And look it up on my website, bregan.com. And again, thanks, you wonderful audience, and thank you, Michael Fontaine.